This area had 10 or 11 upscale eateries. Which would his quarry choose? It turned out to be the Prince Michael of Kiev, a Ukrainian establishment specializing in chicken and fish, known also for its fine bar. Konyev/Suvorov pulled over and allowed the restaurant's valet to park his vehicle, then walked in. "Who's the best dressed among us?" Provorov asked over the radio.
"You are, Comrade Lieutenant."
His other two teams were attired as working-class people, and that wouldn't fly here. Half of the Prince Michael of Kiev's clientele were foreigners, and you had to dress well around such people. The restaurant saw to that. Provorov jumped out half a block away and walked briskly to the canopied entrance. The doorman admitted him after a look. In the new Russia, clothing made the man more than in most European nations. He could have flashed his police ID, but that might not be a good move. Konyev/Suvorov might well have some of the restaurant staff reporting to him. That was when he had a flash of imagination. Provorov immediately entered the men's lavatory and pulled out his cellular phone.
"Hello?"
a familiar voice said on picking up the receiver.
"Mishka?"
"Oleg?"
Riley asked.
"What can I do for you?"
"Do you know a restaurant called the Prince Michael of Kiev?"
"Yeah, sure. Why?"
"I need your help."
"How quickly can you get here?" Provorov asked, knowing that Riley lived only 2 kilometers away.
10 or 15 minutes.
"Quickly, then. I'll be at the bar."
"Dress presentably,"
the militiaman added.
"Right," Riley agreed, wondering how he'd explain it to his wife, and wondering why he'd had his quiet evening in front of the TV interrupted.
Provorov headed back to the bar, ordered a pepper vodka, and lit a cigarette. His quarry was 7 seats away, also having a solitary drink, perhaps waiting for his table to become available. The restaurant was full. A string quartet was playing some Rimsky-Korsakov on the far side of the dining room. The restaurant was far above anything Provorov could afford as a regular part of his life. So, Konyev/Suvorov was well set financially. That was no particular surprise. A lot of ex-KGB officers were doing very well indeed in the economic system of the new Russia. They had worldly ways and knowledge that few of their fellow citizens could match. In a society known for its burgeoning corruption, they had a corner on the market, and a network of fellow travelers to call upon, with whom they could, for various considerations, share their gains, ill-gotten or not. Provorov had finished his first drink and had motioned to the bartender for another when Riley appeared.
"Oleg Grigorievich," the American said in greeting.
He was no fool, the Russian militia lieutenant realized. The American's Russian was manifestly American and overloud, a fine backward stealth for this environment. He was well-dressed also, proclaiming his foreign origin to all who saw him.
"Mishka,"
Provorov said in response, taking the American's hand warmly and waving to the bartender.
"Okay, who we looking for?" the FBI agent asked more quietly.
"The gray suit. 7 seats to my left."
"Got him,"
Riley said at once.
"Who is he?"
"He is currently under the name Konyev, Ivan Yurievich. In fact, we believe him to be Suvorov, Clemente Ivanich."
"Aha," Riley observed.
"What else can you tell me?"
"We trailed him here. He used a simple but effective evasion method, but we have 3 cars tracking him, and we picked him right back up."
"Good one, Oleg," the FBI agent said.
Inadequately trained and poorly equipped or not, Provorov was a no-shit copper. In the Bureau, he'd be at least a supervisory special agent. Oleg had fine cop instincts. Tracking a KGB type around Moscow was no trivial exercise, like following a paranoid button man in Queens. Riley sipped his pepper vodka and turned sideways in his seat. On the far side of the subject was a dark-haired beauty wearing a slinky black dress. She looked like another of those expensive hookers to Riley,
and her shingle was out. Her dark eyes were surveying the room as thoroughly as his. The difference was that Riley was a guy, and looking at a pretty girl, or seeming to, was not the least bit unusual. In fact, his eyes were locked not on the woman, but the man. 50-ish, well turned out, nondescript in overall appearance, just as a spy was supposed to be, looked to be waiting for a table, nursing his drink and looking studiously in the bar's mirror, which was a fine way to see if he were being watched. The American and his Russian friend he dismissed, of course. What interest could an American businessman have in him, after all? And besides, the American was eyeing the whore to his left. For that reason, the subject's eyes did not linger on the men to his right, either directly or in the mirror. Oleg was smart, Riley thought, using him as camouflage for his discreet surveillance. "Anything else turn lately?" the FBI agent asked. Provolov filled in what he'd learned about the hooker and what had happened the night before the murders. "Damn, that is swashbuckling. But you still don't know who the target was, do you?" "No," Provolov admitted, with a sip of his second drink. He'd have to go easy on the alcohol, he knew, lest he make a mistake. His quarry was too slick and dangerous to take any sort of risk at all. He could always bring the guy in for questioning, but he knew that would be a fruitless exercise. Criminals like this one had to be handled as gently as a cabinet minister. Provolov allowed his eyes to look into the mirror, where he got a good look at the profile of a probable multiple murderer. Why was it that there was no black halo around such people? Why did they look normal? "Anything else we know about the mutt?" The Russian had come to like that American term. He shook his head. "No, Mishka, we haven't checked with SVR yet." "Worried that he might have a source inside the building?" the American asked. Oleg nodded. "That is a consideration." "And an obvious one. The fraternity of former KGB officers was probably a tight one. There might well be someone inside the old headquarters building, say someone in personnel records, who'd let people know if the police showed interest in any particular file." "Damn," the American noted, thinking, "you son of a bitch, fucking the guy's hookers before you waste him." There was a disagreeable coldness to it, like something from a mafia movie. But in real life, La Cosa Nostra members didn't have the stones for such a thing. Formidable as they might be, mafia button men didn't have the training of a professional intelligence officer, and were tabby cats next to panthers in this particular jungle. Further scrutiny of the subject. The girl beyond him was a distraction, but not that much. "Oleg?"
"Yes, Mikhail."
He's looking at somebody over by the musicians. His eyes keep coming back to the same spot. He isn't scanning the room like he was at first. The subject did check out everyone who came into the restaurant, but his eyes kept coming back to one part of the mirror, and he'd probably determined that nobody in the place was a danger to him. Oops. Well, Riley thought, even training has its limitations. And sooner or later, your own expertise could work against you. You fell into patterns, and you made assumptions that could get you caught. In this case, Suvorov assumed that no American could be watching him. After all, he'd done nothing to any Americans in Moscow, and maybe not in his entire career. And he was on friendly, not foreign ground, and he'd dusted off his tail on the way over in the way he always did, looking for a single tail car. Well, the smart ones knew their limitations. How did it go? The difference between genius and stupidity was that genius knew that it had limits. This Suvorov guy thought himself a genius. But whom was he looking at? Riley turned a little more on his bar stool and scanned that part of the room.
"What do you see, Mishka?"
"A lot of people, Oleg Grigorievich, mainly Russians. Some foreigners, all well-dressed. Some Chinese. Look like two diplomats dining with two Russians. They look like official types.
Looks cordial enough, Riley thought.
He'd eaten here with his wife 3 or 4 times. The food was pretty good, especially the fish. And they had a good source of caviar at the Prince Michael of Kiev, which was one of the best things you could get over here. His wife loved it, and would have to learn that getting it at home would be a lot more expensive than it was here. Riley had done discreet surveillance for so many years that he had trained himself to be invisible. He could fit in just about any place but Harlem, and the Bureau had black agents to handle that. Sure as hell, that Suvorov guy was looking in the same place. Casually, perhaps, and using the bar's mirror to do it. He even sat so that his eyes naturally looked at the same place as he sat on his bar stool. But people like this subject didn't do anything by accident or coincidence. They were trained to think through everything, even taking a leak. It was remarkable, then, that he'd been turned so stupidly. By a hooker who'd gone through his things while he was sleeping off an orgasm. Well, some men, no matter how smart, fought with their dicks. Riley turned again. One of the Chinese men at the distant table excused himself and stood, heading for the men's room. Riley thought to do the same at once, but no. If it were prearranged, such a thing could spook it. Patience, Mishka, he told himself, turning back to look at the principal subject. Konyev / Suvorov set down his drink and stood.
Oleg, I want you to point me toward the men's room, the FBI agent said. In 15 seconds.
Provolov counted out the time, then extended his arm toward the main entrance. Riley patted him on the shoulder and headed that way. The Prince Michael of Kiev restaurant was nice, but it didn't have a bathroom attendant, as many European places did. Perhaps because Americans were uneasy with the custom. Or maybe because the management thought it an unnecessary expense. Riley entered and saw 3 urinals, 2 of them being used. He unzipped and urinated, then re-zipped and turned to wash his hands, looking down as he did so. And just out of the corner of his eye, he saw the other 2 men share a sideways look. The Russian was taller. The men's room had the sort of pull-down roller towel that America had largely done away with. Riley pulled it down and dried his hands, unable to wait too much longer. Heading toward the door, he reached in his pocket and pulled his car keys part of the way out. These he dropped just as he pulled the door open, with a muttered, "Damn," as he bent down to pick them up, shielded from their view by the steel divider. Riley picked them off the tile floor and stood back up. Then he saw it. It was well done. They could have been more patient, but they probably both discounted the importance of the American, and both were trained professionals. They scarcely touched each other, and what touching and bumping there was happened below the waist and out of sight to the casual observer. Riley wasn't a casual observer, however, and even out of the corner of his eyes it was obvious to the initiated. It was a classic brush pass. So well done that even Riley's experience couldn't determine who had passed what to whom. The FBI agent continued out, heading back to his seat at the bar, where he waved to the barkeep for the drink he figured he'd just earned.
Yes?
You want to identify that Chinaman. He and our friend traded something in the shitter.
Brush pass, and nicely done, Riley said, with a smile and a gesture at the brunette down the bar.
Good enough, in fact, that had Riley been forced to sit in a witness stand and describe it to a jury, a week-old law school graduate could make him admit that he hadn't actually seen anything at all. But that told him much. That degree of skill was either the result of a totally chance encounter between 2 entirely innocent people, the purest of coincidences, or it had been the effort of 2 trained intelligence officers applying their craft at a perfect place in a perfect way. Provolov was turned the right way to see the 2 individuals leave the men's room. They didn't even notice each other, or didn't appear to acknowledge the presence of the other any more than they would have greeted a stray dog. Exactly as 2 unrelated people would act after a happenstance encounter with a total stranger in any men's room anywhere. But this time, as Konyev
Suvorov resumed his seat at the bar. He tended to his drink and didn't have his eyes interrogate the mirror regularly. In fact, he turned and greeted the girl to his left, then waved for the bartender to get her another drink, which she accepted with a warm commercial smile. Her face proclaimed the fact that she'd found her trick for the night. The girl could act, Riley thought.
"Well, our friend's going to get laid tonight," he told his Russian colleague.
"She is pretty," Provorov agreed.
23, you think?"
"Thereabouts. Maybe a little younger. Nice hooters."
"Hooters?"
the Russian asked.
"Tits, Oleg, tits," the FBI agent clarified.
"That Chinaman's a spook. See any coverage on him around?"
"No one I know," the lieutenant replied.
"Perhaps he is not known to be an intelligence officer."
"Yeah, sure, your counterintelligence people have all retired to Sochi, right?"
"Hell, guy, they trail me every so often."
"That means I am one of your agents, then?" Provorov asked.
A chuckle.
"Let me know if you want to defect, Oleg Grigorievich."
"The Chinese in the light blue suit?" "That's the one. Short, about 5'4", 155, pudgy, short hair, about 45 or so."
Provorov translated that to about 163 centimeters and 70 kilos, and made a mental note as he turned to look at the face, about 30 meters away. He looked entirely ordinary, as most spies did. With that done, he headed back to the men's room to make a phone call to his agents outside. And that pretty much ended the evening. Konyev / Suvorov left the restaurant about 20 minutes later with the girl on his arm, and drove straight back to his apartment. One of the men who'd stayed behind walked with the Chinese to his car, which had diplomatic plates. Notes were written down, and the cops all headed home after an overtime day, wondering what they'd turned up and how important it might be.
Chapter 20. Diplomacy.
"Well?" Rutledge took his notes back from Secretary Adler.
"It looks okay, Cliff, assuming that you can deliver the message in an appropriate way," Sextate told his subordinate.
"Process is something I understand."
Then he paused.
"The President wants this message delivered in unequivocal terms, correct?"
Secretary Adler nodded.
"Yep."
"You know, Scott, I've never really landed on people this hard before."
"Ever want to?"
"The Israelis a few times. South Africa," he added thoughtfully.
"But never the Chinese or Japanese?"
"Scott, I've never been a trade guy before, remember?"
"But he was this time because the mission to Beijing was supposed to be high profile, requiring a higher-level diplomat instead of someone of mere ambassadorial rank. The Chinese knew this already. In their case, negotiations would be handled publicly by their foreign minister, though they would actually be run by a lesser-ranked diplomat who was a foreign trade specialist, and who had experienced a good run of luck dealing with America." Secretary Adler, with President Ryan's permission, was slowly leaking to the press that the times and the rules might have changed a little bit. He worried that Cliff Rutledge wasn't exactly the right guy to deliver the message, but Cliff was the on-deck batter.
"How are you working out with this Gantt guy from Treasury?"
"If he were a diplomat, we'd be at war with the whole damned world, but I suppose he does know numbers and computers, probably," Rutledge allowed, not troubling to hide his distaste for the Chicago-born Jew with his nouveau riche ways. That Rutledge had been of modest origins himself was long forgotten. A Harvard education and a diplomatic passport help one forget such distasteful things as having grown up in a row house eating leftovers.
"Remember that Winston likes him, and Ryan likes Winston, okay?" Adler warned his subordinate gently.
He decided not to concern himself with Cliff's waspish anti-Semitism. Life was too short for trivialities, and Rutledge knew that his career rested in Scott Adler's hands. He might make more money as a consultant after leaving the State Department,
but being fired out of Foggy Bottom would not enhance his value on the free agent market.
Okay, Scott, and yeah, I need backup on the monetary aspects of this trade stuff.
The accompanying nod was almost respectful.
Good.
He did know how to grovel when required.
Adler didn't even consider telling Rutledge about the intelligence source in his pocket, courtesy of POTUS. There was something about the career diplomat that failed to inspire trust in his superior.
What about communications?
The embassy in Beijing has tap dance capability. Even the new phone kind, same as the airplane.
But there were problems with it, recently fielded by Fort Meade. The instruments had trouble linking up with each other, and using a satellite lash-up didn't help at all. Like most diplomats, Rutledge rarely troubled himself with such trivialities. He often expected the intelligence to appear as if by magic, rarely wondering how it had been obtained, but always questioning the motives of the source, whoever that might be. All in all, Clifford Rutledge II was the perfect diplomat. He believed in little beyond his own career, some vague notions of international amity, and his personal ability to make it come about, and to avoid war through the sheer force of his brilliance. But on the plus side, Adler admitted to himself, Rutledge was a competent diplomatic technician who knew how the banter worked, and how to present a position in the gentlest possible but still firm terms. The State Department never had enough of those. As someone had once remarked of Theodore Roosevelt, "The nicest gentleman who ever slit a throat." But Cliff would never do that, even to advance his own career. He probably shaved with an electric razor, not for fear of cutting himself, so much as fear of actually seeing blood. "When's your plane leave?" Eagle asked his subordinate.
Barry Wise was already packed. He was an expert at it, as well he might be, because he traveled about as much as an international airline pilot. At 54, the black ex-Marine had worked for CNN since its beginnings more than 20 years before, and he'd seen it all. He'd covered the Contras in Nicaragua, and the first bombing missions in Baghdad. He'd been there when mass graves were excavated in Yugoslavia, and done live commentary over Rwanda's roads of death, simultaneously wishing that he could, and thanking God that he could not, broadcast the ghastly smells that still haunted his dreams. A news professional, Wise regarded his mission in life to be this: to transmit the truth from where it happened to where people were interested in it, and helping them to become interested if they were not. He didn't have much of a personal ideology, though he was a great believer in justice. And one of the ways to make justice happen was to give the correct information to the jury. In his case, the television-watching public. He and people like him had changed South Africa from a racist state into a functioning democracy. And he'd also played a role in destroying world communism. The truth, he figured, was about the most powerful weapon in the world, if you had a way of getting it to the average Joe. Unlike most members of his business, Wise respected Joe Citizen, at least the ones who were smart enough to watch him. They wanted the truth, and it was his job to deliver it to them to the best of his abilities, which he often doubted, as he constantly asked himself how well he was doing. He kissed his wife on the way out the door, promising to bring back things for the kids, as he always did, and lugging his travel bag out to his one personal indulgence, a red Mercedes two-seater, which he then drove south to the D.C. Beltway and south again toward Andrews Air Force Base. He had to arrive early because the Air Force had gotten overly security-conscious. Maybe it was from that dumbass movie that had had terrorists getting past all the armed guards. Even though they were merely Air Force, not Marines, they did carry rifles, and they did at least appear to be competent. And aboard one of the 89th Military Airlift Wing's aircraft, which, Wise figured, was about as likely as having a pickpocket walk into the Oval Office and lift the President's wallet. But the military followed its own rules, senseless though they might be. That was something he remembered well from his time in the Corps. So he'd drive down, pass through all the checkpoints, whose guards knew him better than they knew their own CO,
and wait in the plush, distinguished visitor's lounge at the end of Andrews Runway 01 left for the official party to arrive. Then they'd board the venerable VC-137 for the endless flight to Beijing. The seats were as comfortable as they could be on an airplane, and the service was as good as any airline's first class. But flights this long were never fun.
"Never been there before," Mark Gant said, answering George Winston's question.
"So, what's the score on this Rutledge guy?"
The Secretary shrugged.
"Career State Department puke, worked his way pretty far up the ladder. Used to have good political connections. He was tight with Ed Kielty once upon a time."
The former stock trader looked up.
"Oh? Why hasn't Ryan fired his ass?"
"Jack doesn't play that sort of game," Winston replied, wondering if in this case principle was getting in the way of common sense.
"George, he's still pretty naive, isn't he?"
"Maybe so, but he's a straight shooter, and I can live with that. He sure as hell backed us up on tax policy, and that's going to pass through Congress in another few weeks."
Gant wouldn't believe that until he saw it. "Assuming every lobbyist in town doesn't jump in front of the train."
That engendered an amused grunt.
"So the wheels get greased a little better.
You know, wouldn't it be nice to close all those bastards down?"
"George," Gant couldn't say in this office, "if you believe that, you've been hanging out with the president too long."
"But idealism wasn't all that bad a thing, was it?"
"I'll settle for squeezing those Chinese bastards on the trade balance."
"Ryan's going to back us up?"
"All the way, he says."
"And I believe him, Mark."
"I guess we'll see. I hope this Rutledge guy can read numbers."
"He went to Harvard," Secretary Winston observed.
"I know," Gant said back.
He had his own academic prejudice, having graduated from the University of Chicago 20 years earlier. What the hell was Harvard except a name and an endowment?
Winston chuckled.
"They're not all dumb."
"I suppose we'll see, boss. Anyway," he lifted his suitcase up on its rollers. His computer bag went over his shoulder.
"My car's waiting downstairs."
"Good trip, Mark."
Her name was Yang Lianhua. She was 34, 9 months pregnant, and very frightened. It was her second pregnancy. Her first had been a son whom they had named Zhu Long, a particularly auspicious given name, which translated roughly as large dragon. But the youngster had died at the age of 4, bumped by a bicycle off the sidewalk into the path of a passenger bus. His death had devastated his parents, and even saddened the local Communist Party officials who'd officiated at the inquest, which had absolved the bus driver of guilt and never identified the careless bicyclist. The loss had been sufficiently hard on Mrs. Yang that she'd sought comfort in a way that this country's government did not especially approve. That way was Christianity, the foreign religion despised in fact, if not exactly in law. In another age, she might have found solace in the teachings of Buddha or Confucius. But these too had been largely erased from the public consciousness by the Marxist government, which still regarded all religion as a public narcotic. A co-worker had quietly suggested that she meet a friend of hers, a man named Yu Fa An. Mrs. Yang had sought him out, and so had begun her first adventure in treason. Reverend Yu, she found, was a well-educated and traveled man, which added to his stature in her eyes. He was also a fine listener, who attended to her every word, occasionally pouring her some sympathetic tea, and gently touching her hand when tears streamed down her face. Only when she had finished her tale of woe had he begun his own lessons. Zhu Long, he told her, was with God, because God was especially solicitous to the needs of innocent children. While she could not see her son at this moment, her son could see her, looking down from heaven. And while her sorrow was completely understandable, she should believe that the God of the earth was a God of mercy and love,
who had sent his only begotten Son to earth to show mankind the right path, and to give his own life for the sins of humanity. He handed her a Bible printed in the Goryeo, the national language of the PRC, also called Mandarin, and helped her find appropriate passages. It had not been easy for Mrs. Yang, but so deep was her grief that she kept returning for private counseling, finally bringing along her husband, Quan. Mr. Yang proved a harder sell on any religion. He'd served his time in the People's Liberation Army, where he'd been thoroughly indoctrinated in the politics of his nation, and done sufficiently well in his test answers to be sent off to sergeant school, for which political reliability was required. But Quan had been a good father to his little large dragon, and he too found the void in his belief system too large to bridge easily. This bridge the Reverend Yu provided, and soon both of the Yangs came to his discreet church services, and gradually they'd come to accept their loss with confidence in the continued life of Julong, and the belief that they would some day see him again in the presence of an almighty God, whose existence became increasingly real to both of them. Until then, life had to go on. Both worked at their jobs as factory workers in the same factory, with a working-class apartment in the Jianmen district of Beijing near Jingshan, Coal Hill Park. They labored at their factory during the day, watched state-run television at night, and in due course, Lianhua became pregnant again, and ran afoul of the government's population control policy that was well to the left of draconian. It had long since been decreed that any married couple could have but one child. A second pregnancy required official government permission. Though this was not generally denied to those whose first child had died, pro forma permission had to be obtained, and in the case of politically unacceptable parents, this permission was generally withheld as a method of controlling the living population as well. That meant that an unauthorized pregnancy had to be terminated, safely and at state expense in a state hospital, but terminated. Christianity translated exactly into political unreliability for the communist government, and unsurprisingly the Ministry of State Security had inserted intelligence officers into Reverend Yu's congregation. This individual, actually there were three, lest one be corrupted by religion and become unreliable himself, had entered the names of the Yangs on a master list of political unreliables. For that reason, when Mrs. Yang Lianhua had duly registered her pregnancy, an official letter had appeared in her box, instructing her to go to the Longfu Hospital located on Meishuguan Street for a therapeutic abortion. This Lianhua was unwilling to do. Her given name translated as Lotus Flower, but inside she was made of much sterner stuff. She wrote a week later to the appropriate government agency, telling them that her pregnancy had miscarried. Given the nature of bureaucracies, her lie was never checked out. That lie had merely won Lotus Flower 6 months of ever-increasing stress. She never saw a physician, not even one of the barefoot medics that the PRC had invented a generation earlier, much to the admiration of political leftists all over the world. Lianhua was healthy and strong, and the human body had been designed by nature to produce healthy offspring long before the advent of obstetricians. Her swelling belly she was able to hide, mostly, in her ill-fitting clothing. What she could not hide, at least from herself, was her inward fear. She carried a new baby in her belly. She wanted it. She wanted to have another chance at motherhood. She wanted to feel her child suckling at her breast. She wanted to love it and pamper it, watch it learn to crawl and stand and walk and talk, to see it grow beyond 4 years, enter school, learn and grow into a good adult of whom she could be proud. The problem was politics. The state enforced its will with ruthlessness. She knew what could happen. The syringe filled with formaldehyde stabbed into the baby's head at the very moment of birth. In China, it was state policy. For the Yangs, it was premeditated, cold-blooded murder. And they were determined not to lose a second child, who, the Reverend Yu had told them, was a gift from God himself. And there was a way. If you delivered the baby at home without medical assistance, and if the baby took its first breath, then the state would not kill it. There were some things even the government of the People's Republic quailed at, and the killing of a living, breathing human infant was one of them. But until it took that breath, it was of no more consequence than a piece of meat in a market. There were even rumors that the Chinese government was selling organs from the aborted newborns on the world's tissue market, to be used for medical purposes, and that was something the Yangs were able to believe. So their plan was for Lianhua to deliver the child at home, after which they would present their state with a fait accompli, and eventually have it baptized by Reverend Yu. To this end, Mrs. Yang had kept herself in good physical shape, walking 2 kilometers every day, eating sensibly, and generally doing all the things the government-published booklets told expectant mothers to do. And if anything went badly wrong, they'd go to Reverend Yu for counsel and advice. The plan enabled Lianhua to deal with the stress. In fact, it was a heart-rending terror of her unauthorized condition.
"Well?" Ryan asked.
"Rutledge has all the right talents, and we've given him the instructions he needs. He ought to carry them out properly. Question is, will the Chinese play ball?"
"If they don't, things become harder for them," the president said. "If not coldly, then with some degree of determination. If they think they can bully us, Scott, it's time they found out who the big kid in the playground is."
"They'll fight back. They've taken out options on 14 Boeing 777s. Just did that 4 days ago, remember? That's the first thing they'll chop if they don't like us. That's a lot of money and a lot of jobs for Boeing in Seattle," Sextate warned.
"I never have been real big on blackmail, Scott. Besides, that's a classic case of penny-wise, pound-foolish. If we cave because of that, then we lose 10 times the money and 10 times the jobs elsewhere. Okay, they won't all be in one place, and so the TV news guys won't be able to point their cameras, and so they won't do the real story, just the one that can fit on half-inch tape. But I'm not in here to keep the goddamn media happy. I'm here to serve the people to the best of my ability, Scott, and that's by God going to happen," POTUS promised his guest.
"I don't doubt it, Jack," Adler responded. "Just remember that it won't play out quite the way you want it to."
"It never does. But if they play rough, it's going to cost them $70 billion a year. We can afford to do without their products. Can they afford to do without our money?" Ryan asked.
Secretary Adler was not totally comfortable with the way the question was posed.
"I suppose we'll have to wait and see."
Chapter 21. Simmering.
"So, what did you develop last night?" Riley asked. He'd be late to his embassy office, but his gut told him that things were breaking loose in the RPG case. That was how he thought of it. And Director Murray had a personal interest in the case, because the president did, and that made it more important than the routine bullshit on Riley's desk.
"Our Chinese friend, the one in the men's room, that is the third secretary at their mission. Our friends across town at SVR have suspected that he is a member of their Ministry for State Security. He's not regarded as a particularly bright diplomat by the foreign ministry. Ours, that is."
"That's how you cover a spook," Riley agreed. "A dumb cookie pusher."
"Okay, so he's a player."
"I agree, Mishka," Provolov said. "Now it would be nice to know who passed what to whom."
"Oleg Grigorievich," Riley liked the semi-formal Russian form of address. "If I'd been standing right there and staring, I might not have been able to tell."
That was the problem dealing with real professionals. They were as good at that maneuver as a Las Vegas dealer was with a deck of bicycles. You needed a good lens and a slow-motion camera, to be sure, and that was a little bulky for work in the field. But they'd just proved, to their satisfaction at least, that both men were active in the spook business, and that was a break in the case any way you sliced it.
ID the girl?
Yelena Ivanova Dimitrova.
Provalov handed the folder across.
Just a whore, but of course a very expensive one.
Riley flipped it open and scanned the notes. Known prostitute specializing in foreigners. The photo of her was unusually flattering.
You came in early this morning? Riley asked.
He must have, to have all this work done already.
Before 6, Oleg confirmed.
The case was becoming more exciting for him as well.
In any case, Clementi Ivanich kept her all night. She left his apartment and caught a taxi home at 7:40 this morning. She looked happy and satisfied, according to my people.
That was good for a chuckle.
She didn't leave her trick until after Oleg hit the office.
That must have affected his attitude somewhat, Riley thought with an inward grin.
It sure as hell would have affected his.
Well, good for our subject. I expect he won't be getting too much of that in a few months, the FBI agent thought aloud, hoping it would make his Russian colleague a little happier about life.
One can hope, Provalov agreed coldly.
I have 4 men watching his apartment. If he leaves and appears to be heading away for a while, I will try to get a team into his apartment to plant some electronic surveillance.
They know how to be careful? Riley asked.
If this Suvorov mutt was as trained as they thought, he'd leave telltales in his apartment that could make breaking in dicey.
They are KGB trained also. One of them helped catch a French intelligence officer back in the old times.
Now I have a question for you, the Russian cop said.
Shoot.
What do you know of a special counter-terrorist group based in England?
The Men of Black, you mean?
Provalov nodded.
Yes. Do you know anything about them?
Riley knew he had to watch his words, even though he knew damned little.
Really, I don't know anything more than what I've seen in the papers. It's some sort of multinational NATO group, part military and part police, I think. They had a good run of luck last year.
Why do you ask?
A request from on high, because I know you.
I've been told that they are coming to Moscow to assist in training our people. Spetsnaz groups with similar tasks, Oleg explained.
Really?
Well, I've never been in the muscle end of the Bureau, just in a local SWAT team once. Gus Werner probably knows a lot about them. Gus runs the new counter-terrorism division at headquarters. Before that, Gus ran HRT and had a field command. A field division, that is. A big city field office. I've met him once just to say hello. Gus has a very good service rep.
Rep?
Reputation, Oleg. He's well regarded by the field agents. But, like I said, that's the muscle end of the Bureau. I've always been with the chess players.
Investigations, you mean?
Riley nodded.
That's right.
It's what the FBI is supposed to be all about. But the outfit's mutated a bit over the years.
The American paused.
So, you're covering this Suvorov-Konyev guy real tight? Riley asked, to recenter the discussion.
My men have orders to be discreet, but yes, we will keep a close eye on him, as you say.
You know, if he really is working with the Chinese spooks, do you think they might want to kill that Golovko guy?
I do not know, but we must regard that as a real possibility.
Riley nodded, thinking this would make an interesting report to send to Washington, and maybe discuss with the CIA station chief as well.
I want the files for everyone who ever worked with him, Sergei Nikolaevich ordered, and I want you to get me his personal file.